You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Just over 20 years ago, a new movement aimed to change the way teens think about sex and to get them to hold off on sex until marriage. Often tied to evangelical Christianity, organizations like True Love Waits and the Silver Ring Thing brought their message to tens of thousands of teens in their first years, millions since then.
While those and other purity movements don't have as much attention in popular culture now as they did then, there are still active parts of American society. The Silver Ring Thing tours the nation with a live show with a stop in Wisconsin last year and has events scheduled for this fall and around the country. And True Love Waits is still encouraging teens to sign purity pledges.
Our next guest traces the origins of the modern purity movement and says it has deeper roots than we might think. Sarah Mosliner joins us now. She's assistant professor of religion at Central Michigan University. Her new book is Virgin Nation, Sexual Purity and American Adolescence. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So how influential have these modern purity movements been since they started back in the 90s?
Very much so. And we could even go back further and talk about the 1980s. And this is really when people started thinking about wanting funding for abstinence-only education. That started in 1981. So we can go back even further, just looking at the contemporary context. And since then, as I show in my book, there has been an increased not only public but also political attention to sexual abstinence. When I was in high school myself, even as an evangelical, the concept of sexual purity wasn't something we talked about, but now everyone knows what it means. And most of the students I currently teach, even at a large public institution, get some form of this in their sex education. So even people who are not part of the evangelical subculture have been deeply impacted by the purity movement.
And that's part of the big shift that groups like True Love Waits and the Silver Ring Thing, you focus on them in your book. They took this from what might have been a private conversation in a family or maybe in a church to a public conversation in schools and people making these public statements, these public pledges for everyone else to know about.
Absolutely. That's absolutely right. And I try and be careful about not critiquing people who do have these private conversations and make these commitments within the privacy of their relationships, of their family life, of their premarital life. What I'm more concerned with is the movement, a movement which says our way of being in the world is essential to the thriving of the United States. And that's when we all need to start paying attention, because they're not just saying, hey, if you're a Christian and you believe this way, we want to support you. It's going further to say this has implications for our entire nation state.
Well, let's dig into what happens, what these groups do. Let's start with True Love Waits. Give us a little more detail about what they've done since the 90s and the pledges that they have focused on.
Of course. So one of the earliest things they did made it evident that they weren't just interested in keeping this a local kind of small town, local church event. One of the first things they did was at an event on the National Mall in 1993. They pounded into the ground about 20,000 pledge cards. As a form of a national display to show to everyone in the nation's capital, look, here are thousands of young people who have made this pledge to sexual purity, to remaining pure until marriage, and we are making a political statement by doing that. We are political actors. And that was a significant move and a way to draw in other people beyond the Southern Baptist context. So unlike other groups, Silver Ring Thing is not focused on a particular show that they may tour around the country. They have materials that they make available to churches. So local churches will purchase the materials, schools will purchase the materials and put on their own events. There is, of course, a roster of speakers that you can bring in to any event that you have, either at your school or at your church, who will talk about it. And so, of course, people know who this network is that they can draw on to bring in into any kind of True Love Waits event. So they provide the materials, but then local organizations will put on the events themselves.
And then that's True Love Waits. The Silver Ring thing, as you mentioned, it's a show. It tours pretty lively and sounds like drawing a lot from the state-of-the-art media of the day.
Exactly. I think it was Sean Cole from Massachusetts Public Radio who called it part rave, part Saturday Night Live, part Saturday Night Revival. And that's exactly what it is. It is very attention-getting. It is carefully planned to attract the adolescent imagination. And one of the things I noticed is, you know, for the first 40 minutes, you see more references to someone like Will Ferrell than you do Jesus Christ. And so there's really an attempt to attract people who have not been part of a church, been part of the evangelical subculture, and that's done very intentionally.
Talking to Sarah Mosliner from Central Michigan University. Her new book is Virgin Nation, Sexual Purity and American Adolescence, looking at purity movements, groups like True Love Waits and others calling for purity pledges, virginity pledges. And Sarah, you alluded to this earlier. You're concerned that this isn't just a personal message about personal behavior. A lot is riding on this for these groups, saying that the fate of the nation in many ways hangs on this. How is that? How do they make that connection?
Right. So this is something that came out in bits and pieces in my initial research into the contemporary movement. I kept hearing things about the decline of civilizations and bringing revival to America. And so there was this connection they were making between people taking sexual purity pledges and the thriving of the nation state. And I wanted to see where that came from. And I actually went back through the 20th century and found other times when evangelicals, fundamentalists, even more progressive evangelicals of the 19th century, first wave feminists, in fact, who used this same construction to assert the importance of sexual purity. And so that's something I found consistent. And something that isn't as evident in today's purity movement. So if you go to the events that it sounds like they're coming to Wisconsin, you won't necessarily see much of this rhetoric, but it's very much underneath the surface, this belief that this is something that isn't just about what's good for the individual. It's about protecting the nation state, because if people are getting into marriages not being sexually pure, those marriages are going to be faulty, and if the marriages are faulty, the children from those marriages will be delinquent, and on until you have a crumbling social structure. And this is something that has been used since the 19th century in response to fears about the decline of Anglo-Saxon civilization. It was used in the 1950s by people who feared the communists. It was a way for Americans to protect themselves against communist incursion. And it was a way in the 1970s for people to protect themselves against what they believed were the excesses of the sexual revolution. And so you see that in all of these different places historically.
And you write that other scholars have seen these purity movements as a reaction to that last thing you mentioned, the sexual revolution of the 60s into the 70s. You say this is a tradition that goes back, I mean, there's partly that's true, but it goes back way further than that.
Exactly. And so if I were to have written this book just starting with the rise of the religious right, I would have seen the use of therapeutic rhetoric, the emphasis on the individual, using popular media, all of these things that are really hallmarks of contemporary late 20th century religion. But as I said, that's what what I had seen for the most part, but when I started seeing this other current about national decline, that really raised some question marks, and I knew I had to go further back. Because nowadays, people don't respond a lot to the fire and brimstone theology. They want to hear theologies of self-care. This is what we call the therapeutic, that God is taking care of you, God wants the best of you. And that's primarily what you will hear if you go to these events. But just underneath that is this more long-term theology that connects these ideas to the well-being of the nation state and to these fears that the United States is going to be rendered somehow less powerful based on the individual choices people make with their sexuality.
We're talking to Sarah Mosliner about purity movements and virginity pledges in the United States. Her new book is Virgin Nation, Sexual Purity and American Adolescence.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these purity movements? Are they sending a positive message to young people, or do you see a downside? Have you participated in one of these purity movements as an organizer, maybe even taken a pledge yourself? Call 800-642-1234. We continue our conversation about sexual purity movements here in the United States. Sarah Mosliner is our guest. She's an assistant professor of religion at Central Michigan University, and her new book is called Virgin Nation, Sexual Purity and American Adolescence.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions. What do you think of this idea of teens taking virginity pledges? Have you been involved with one of the movements our guest is talking about, groups like True Love Waits or the Silver Ring thing? What impact did that have on your life? Call 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Jan on the line in Duluth, Minnesota. Jan, hi.
Hi, hi. I'm 70 years old, so I'm a real old-timer. Back when I was, say, eighth grade, so it would have been like 1958, we, too, knew better than to have sex. But what we had was like a golden bracelet that had the Teen Commandments on it. And I couldn't afford it, but some kids could. And it had things like stop and think before you drink. They were just short little things that would be a commandment for a teen. But I think that's, I don't know, that just kind of is strange to me to call it purity. I never considered myself pure, and I don't know, the meek shall inherit the earth.
All right, Jan, thank you so much for that call. So the Teen Commandments in that Cold War era you were talking about, Sarah, but was it thought of in terms of purity then in the 50s as it is now in these contemporary movements?
Yeah, it's really, that's a really fascinating to hear. I know in the 19th century, young people would often wear silver crowns or shields as a sign if they have, when they did take pledges. I hadn't heard about these bracelets, which is really fascinating. Yeah, the concept of purity is really interesting because it's on the one hand, it's very specific, but it's also very broad. It can mean so many different things. And it hasn't, in the concept itself, hasn't been used throughout the 20th century in the way it has in the late 19th century and in the late 20th century, which I, as a historian, I found very fascinating. What is interesting is that when these groups started in the early 90s, they were using the concept of abstinence, of sexual abstinence, which many people understood to mean sexual intercourse. And so what they discovered is that people found many loopholes and so were able to get around that, and so decided to use the concept of purity to provide a more holistic understanding of what they really meant. So it's interesting that they had to kind of change their language a little bit. And then, of course, purity does give that sense of holiness, of of being set apart in some way. I mean, purity codes are something we see in ancient cultures as a way of setting groups apart from one another. And that's very much, I think, what this movement is trying to make use of.
Jan, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Cheryl in Eau Claire. Cheryl, hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. I tuned in just a few moments ago. I was wondering if your guest's scholarship has extended to investigating really how effective this movement has been in delaying first sexual experience for participating adolescents, young adults.
Cheryl, thanks a lot for that call. And Sarah, that's been a controversy over this organization since the 90s.
Absolutely. And there has been significant research done in the 90s and into the 2000s on just that question. And in fact, most of the scholarship has been around that particular question. And that is certainly stuff that I cover. My question had more to do with the rhetoric that was being used to promote the ideals. And what I did discover, though, is that when religious groups are using scripture or theology or whatever to make their claims, what they're doing is saying it doesn't matter what the science says. We're doing what we're doing because this is what God tells us to do. And so at some point in my research, you know, I was trying to sort through all the debates about the scholarship, about whether it works or doesn't work, and what it even means to say that something works. The very first study said, okay, people who take purity pledges tend to start having sex 2 years later. Okay, well, that delays first intercourse, but it doesn't necessarily keep them from having sex outside of marriage. So is that working? Is that not working? It really depends on who's doing the analysis of that data. But for these groups themselves, what the data says doesn't really matter to them. They're going to keep doing what they're doing because they believe it's been commanded by God.
Talking to Sarah Mosliner, her new book is Virgin Nation, looking at the purity movement in the modern United States and its origins. I want to get into gender messages here, Sarah, mm-hmm. before we run out of time. What are girls and boys hearing about who they are as girls and boys from these movements?
Yes, yeah, certainly. Sexual purity, the concept of it really functions on the basis of traditional gender roles, and by traditional gender roles, I mean roles that were established in the 19th century on the basis of the Victorian family. And what's happened with the religious right is that they have made those gender roles seem like they are biblically based, when in fact they're not. We know marriage and family in the Bible, depending on what part of the Bible you're reading, was very, very different from modern family life. But the claim is these are biblical roles, that men and women have complementary roles to play, and they need to prepare for those roles. And sexual purity, making this commitment, is something that helps you prepare for that role. And it's certainly something that that they make use of. They know the romantic narratives, or rather they assume the romantic narratives are going to draw young women to them. And so in some cases they have to work harder to draw young men to them. One organization stopped using the word purity because it was people felt alienated. The young men felt alienated because it was too girly, and so they're working within these gendered stereotypes in order to get their message across about reifying those same gender roles and saying that, you know, if you follow these things, this is your prescription for happiness. And we will show you how to do that. And certainly in terms of sexual desire, that is very much a gendered norm as well, in terms of girls not having sexual desire and boys having sexual desire. And so it kind of naturalizes these gendered relationships that are deeply problematic.
As we wrap up, you've been following these issues, these movements, for some years now. Mm-hmm. Here in 2015, how do you see them changing, shifting at all, if at all, as we look ahead?
Sure. Well, it's certainly changed. I mean, things really reached their peak during the Bush administration because of the funding that was made available. Obama did things a little differently, and really that's kind of the shift that I look for, is who's going to be the next person who is making funding available and who is it being made available to. And certainly Republicans tend to very much favor abstinence-only education. Democrats favor a comprehensive education. And you can tell, depending on who is in the White House, what is sort of being given the most attention and funding. Otherwise, it's interesting, especially with the recent ruling on gay marriage. People have been asking me if, you know, GLBT people might, you know, jump on to this purity movement, which I don't think will happen, but that certainly adds a new layer of analysis for people who are in the business of protecting what they believe to be biblical marriage.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Sarah Mosliner, assistant professor of religion at Central Michigan University. We've been talking about her new book, Virgin Nation, Sexual Purity and American Adolescence.